Hello, hello. Welcome back to another episode of Nocturnal Emissions. I am so, so sorry for this episode being a day late. The only reason that I have, which is not a good reason, is that I forgot what day it was. I woke up today and I've been doing like a quarantine routine where I just wake up, I meditate, I exercise, I clean, and I just sat down answering emails, not even processing that it was Tuesday. So the episode is now late. I sincerely apologize, but y'all, things are topsy-turvy over here. I don't know about you, but things are a little weird. I've been chilling inside for 20 some odd days, 20, maybe it's been over 30 days, actually, now that I look at the calendar. And just, yeah, just chilling, just watching devs and hunters. Anyway, that's not why you're here. Tonight's guest is Tim O'Leary, who is a producer, a filmmaker, a writer, and we talk about his latest project, Demon Hunters, which is a queer horror comedy web show. And we talk about the process of transferring over from being a playwright in New York to being a screenwriter in LA. We talk about the odd sexual energy of Adam Driver. We talk about queerness and horror. We talk about it all, babies. I also want to say that I have a live show, live-ish. Let me reiterate. The show is not live. It's not a live recording. It's a recording of past live shows. We've been calling it Nocturnal Live, live-ish. But I host a show here in Seattle once a month, and we haven't been able to hold it for obvious reasons. And what we decided to do was just kind of put together some clips of past performances, some short films, some weird clips that we found from all over the internet, and put it together as a makeshift show. And that is, it goes live this Thursday, and it'll be running throughout the weekend, so you have multiple chances to watch it. And it's just a fun little weird, not safe for work, even though now your work is at inside your house kind of a thing. And it's great if you've never been able to make it up to Seattle to see one of our live shows, because it's really captures the kind of silliness and the mood of one of our shows. So I hope that you guys check that out. I'll link that in the show notes below, along with the rest of Tim's information, so that you can check out and support him. And without further ado, here's the show. Bye. Hello out there. It is I, your not so humble host, Isabella L. Price, coming back from the grave. That's right, reanimator style. Some fluid was injected into the back of my spine, and I'm back on the airwaves. You thought you could stake me, behead me, burn me at the stake, but nothing works, darling. I'm back with a new skincare regime and also with a very special guest, Tim O'Leary, who is a filmmaker coming out of LA, who is making a web series that I'm very excited to talk about. And I think I'll introduce him right now. Tim!
Hello, how you doing?
How are you?
Fluid in your spine, did it give you like superpowers or turn you into a mutant at all?
It didn't. It just gave me a few more points on my Sephora account, and that's really all that a girl can ask for, really.
Good enough. Yeah, that's fair.
It just gave me like 100 more points on that Sephora card, and I just used it all in skincare. Because, you know, when you've been dead for a while, you really got to moisturize.
That's what I've been told. Yeah, it's important. Important to keep those pores moist.
Just shove the moisture right in those pores. That's how it works. Tim, thank you so much for being on the show with me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
A little bit behind the scenes, we tried to make it work before, but we got a little bit confused with the time. Yes. Time is an illusion.
it's a flat circle, right?
It is a patriarchal structure that I refuse to acknowledge, and But we made it work. We made it work. And now we're here. You're on the show. I'm so happy. Tim, could you please give a little bit of an introduction about who you are and what you do?
Yes, I am an LA-based filmmaker. I'm primarily a writer and director. And by necessity, I am also a producer. And I'm currently working on a series that's the flagship series for my production company, Freaky Fighty Funny Films. And that series is called Demon Hunter, which is an action horror comedy that has a focus on queerness and diversity and tries to bring elements from several genres and also make it sexy. So it's a lot of stuff going in there and one big stirring melting pot of fun.
That's so awesome.
Yeah.
So Demon Hunters, what was the influence behind that?
You know, it's funny. I for a while I lived in New York and I was a struggling playwright. And then I learned that if you want to be a playwright, that also involves taking a vow of poverty for your entire life. And that didn't sound that great to me. So and so I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And then a friend of mine, actually, who was on a soap opera, he had been on a few TV shows, but he had never been a lead. So what he wanted to do was have me write a pilot for a television show for him to star in so that he would have a project that he could bring to pitch to producers and stuff. And so I said, well, do you have an idea of like what you want the show to be? And he said, Werewolves on a Tropical Island. I was like, okay, fine. So I can do that. That works for me. And so I wrote that and we were lucky enough for SAG, the Screen Actors Guild, to choose it to be one of their staged readings in the Salon series that they do. That experience, I met a few producers. They were very nice. They gave me a lot of great advice. But really the one thing that I kept hearing from everyone I talked to said, look, if you want to work in television, you have to move to LA. Once you get established, kind of live anywhere, but you got to live in LA at the beginning of your career. And I said, great, because I'd always been LA curious. I'd always, you know, grown up in the Northeast, but I was, you know, LA looks very sexy when you're always living in New York and it just seems to be perpetually winter. So moved out. And the minute that I got here, I completely fell in love with the town. I fell in love with the environment. I just really, really loved it. It's not full of... Well, I shouldn't say it's not full of flaky people, but it's not. There are great people in LA. Like, there's this myth about LA that everyone is fake and everyone's only interested in their own careers. And while that's true for me, it's not true for other people. So I was like, oh, I really like it. And once I got here, the thing that was to me about LA is that unlike New York, which is a very gritty, grounded city, it's kind of a tough place to live. And you're just around the kind of dregs of humanity a lot of the time. Everyone gets mean. I got mean. But moving to LA, it has a kind of magical, ethereal quality to the actual city. And I think a lot of that is informed by, you know, old Hollywood. So there's this idea of like glamour, but also, of course, that always has a dark side and you hear horrible things happen. So there's murder and there's affairs and all this stuff. And it really feels like the whole place is beautiful during the day and at night all of the ghosts come out. So it's like a very fun, magical place to live. And it makes your mind go in really kind of fun ways. And so once I got here, I was thinking about like what I wanted to write for, you know, for a project. And I kicked around for a few years the idea of two buddies who were mediums who can kind of sense the presence of ghosts and monsters and stuff. And then combine that kind of with a little bit of a Ghostbusters thing where they get hired by people to come and vanquish any beasts that might be in their homes and stuff. And it kind of grew from there. And then in December of 2017, I got serious about writing it. And I brought in my friend Zach Nickum, who's a really fantastic writer. And we just hashed out the first season and then shoot forward 2 years because that's how long indie film takes. We started producing it. So, and here
that's
we are.
Awesome.
Thank you.
It reminds me of, have you seen Marriage Story at all?
Yes, I have, yeah. I resisted it because my parents are divorced. And I'm like, ugh, I don't really want to see it. But yeah, I did.
It was the same. My parents are also divorced. And I was like, okay, for children of divorce, tell me how triggering this is. Am I going to have to call my parents and call my therapist and have them on Skype as I'm watching this movie? Tell me what's going on.
Yeah.
But I'm obsessed, like high-key obsessed with Adam Driver. And I don't know.
Oh, he's amazing.
He's amazing. He's one of the greatest actors that I've seen in this time period. Mm-hmm. His ability to just like do the gamut of emotions is insane.
Yeah.
But also his like oddly sexual horse body.
Yes. He's like not a objectively beautiful man. And yet I am unbearably attracted to him.
It's oh my God. So weird. You live in LA, so you know this, but the Scorpio energy coming off of you see, funny. This is the thing. West Coast queer culture is knowing astrology signs, and this is just.
And I will say, this is where I fall short, because having lived in New York for the majority of my life, like my gut reaction to that is like, oh, for fuck's sake, like I can't handle it. But
I'm so sorry.
No,
but it's a West Coast thing.
Here's the thing: is that like it? What I'm finding, and I admit this begrudgingly, is that there does seem to be truth to that. And I used to think like, oh, it's just like a horoscope, it'll mean whatever you want it to mean, and it's all interpretation and stuff. But then like I have friends who are really into it, as you do when you live in LA, you have friends that are super into astrology. And I was surprised with how specific it is. It really is. Mm-hmm. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. It is. It's a dragging. It's a reading from the stars. Mm-hmm. The stars are reading you to filth. Mm-hmm. And I'm obsessed with astrology. I've always been obsessed with astrology. But he's okay. Wait. Sidebar. What is your sign?
I'm a Virgo, so I'm a virgin.
Okay. Which explains why you made such a horny series.
Why do you seem like you don't believe me? I don't understand what is that. Yeah,
no,
I know.
Nothing. No, we just met. I just, yes. Right. Uh-huh. Okay.
It's so funny. It is like, it is the horniest series that I've ever written. And I didn't quite realize it, but we're in post now. So we're editing all the episodes together.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like, oh, I might have gone a little overboard.
I can't wait. Oh my God, I can't wait. Yeah. But I was gonna say, like, in Marriage Story, the one thing that I absolutely loved that they always do is like whenever they're in New York, New Yorkers are always like, oh my God, LA, the space. Wow. So much space.
It is true though. It's so true. But that's the horrible part of living in New York, is that you're just in these boxes on top of each other, like in this beehive. It's a lot.
You fantasize on the West Coast, you think the West Coast is just nothing but like space. Mm-hmm. And it's true, because LA is so spread out, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like people never really talk about it, but it's like if you live, well, actually it's kind of like New York, because it's like I used to live in the Lower East Side, and I would meet people who would be like, oh, I'm in Queens. And I'd be like, well, it was nice meeting you. I'll never meet you ever again.
We'll never see each other again.
I'm never going to catch the train to Queens. I'm never going to do that. And so, you know, it's the same thing as like when you live in LA, when like people will be in one part of LA, they'll be like, oh, I live in like, oh God, I don't know, Santa Clarita, or they live in
Santa Clarita, fuck that guy.
No, like, well, you'll meet like a really nice person and they'll be like, oh, I live on the other side, and you'll be like, well, I'll never see you ever again, because I can't leave Silver Lake.
Like, I live in West Hollywood. I'm right at the base of the Hollywood Hills, and I have friends who live in Studio City, so it's like kind of right over the hill. Mm-hmm. So realistically, it's about 20 minutes. But every time I think about visiting them, I'm just like, oh God, I don't want to do it. I don't want to climb that mountain.
it's so weird. Like, it's every time that I'm in LA, a friend's like, oh, why don't you come over and see me? And I'm just like, yes, yes, yes. It's so, I can't wait to come see you. And then they're like in Malibu, and I'm like, I'm not going over there. You come see me. No,
right.
I can't do that.
Or meet in Santa Monica. But although no, thank you.
But yeah, Adam Driver has mad BDE, and I don't know what it is. His big dick energy is palpable.
It is, yeah. And I love, like, because you've seen him on Saturday Night Live, I assume.
Yes.
So the fact that like he is funny and clearly like doesn't take himself too seriously, because like when there's the really like dramatic, intense actors, and you feel like they're just always on that level, that's a turnoff for me. Mm-hmm. But if they can do that and deliver that but also be silly, I'm like, oh Jesus, that's like,
and he's
like
hilarious. He's so funny. Every single skit, and it is like he has this face that's very like intimidating and it's very stoic, but he also is just like, this whole thing, all this movie making, TV making, it's all a mirage. None of it's real. And I love that about him.
Yeah.
That has nothing to do with what we're talking about today. But once a day, I need to talk about Adam Driver to somebody. And
I hear you, and I am there with you on that level. I want to take that journey with you.
So I wanted to ask, so this is a horror series that you're working on right now.
Yeah, I don't want to oversell it as a straight horror series, and I don't mean straight as in not gay, but I mean like as like a pure horror series, because it's really not. It's the closest equivalent that I can name is Buffy the Vampire Slayer, which has horror elements to it, but there's a lot of comedy. There's a lot of comedy in it. And the main characters all are formidable fighters or have superpowers, so it's not like monsters chasing like regular human victims. It's a lot more kind of comic booky. But yeah, no, there's certainly horror elements. And one episode we have is pretty much a straight horror episode of the six. So yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's such a long history of horror comedy.
Yeah. Evil Dead. I mean, that, like, how many times have you watched Evil Dead at 11 o'clock at night? And you're like, this is the best movie I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's such a long history. And so I was really excited to hear about something that imbued queerness as well. Mm-hmm. I go to a lot of like horror film festivals, you know, with indie films. And it's actually was at one just this past weekend. And it's a lot of straight dudes.
Making
unfortunate jokes that I think they're trying to be clever and failing at it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, while I was at this film festival, I was with other queer people who were laughing their heads off, and I was so miserable because I was just like, oh, this is like 2009 2009 humor that is like, oh, we're like woke now, like we don't make these kind of like we all had like a reckoning, like Me Too happened, like we don't do this anymore. And it was very odd. And so I'm very excited about your project. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about was your influence of horror. Like, how have you done other horror things? Is this your first horror project?
I've written other horror projects, but this is the first one that I've produced. Horror is probably my favorite genre. It's funny because I've talked to other horror people, and one of the things that I found in the horror fandom, which I just love, is that it is a community that's hungry for the content that they love, and they are kind of unabashed in their love of it. And it doesn't have to be a, you know, $200 million film, and you don't have to have marquee names as the leads. You can just make something that's interesting with, you know, actors you've never seen before. And like the best example is Paranormal Activity, which I'm pretty sure the budget for that was like $15,000. Mm-hmm. And they ended up making like $200 million. Like, you know, obviously that's like the brass ring. But yeah, it's just, that's, you know.
Oh, it's true. I mean, Paranormal Activity was made for like, it was like $15,000 and like a ham sandwich, you know?
Yeah.
And
it looks it. Like, it doesn't look more expensive than a $15,000 movie. And yet it was so engrossing. And that destroyed me. And that was so funny because that was the movie that I insisted on watching when my now husband, Robert Rice, and I first started dating. And he is not a horror guy. He's like, oh, I don't really know if I want to watch this. And so we started to watch it, and I was so into it. And then I don't know if I was, like, actually sick or, I like, the fear made me sick, but I was like, I have to go to bed. And I left him alone, and then he was watching.
He was, like, in love at first sight. I just knew this person.
I could tell if he could tolerate that happening, that we would be okay.
I remember going to go see it, and it had the same kind of marketing behind it as Blair Witch.
Yes.
Where they were, like, this is based on a true story. There was no information that, I mean, this was, oh God, what year did the first one come out? It was like
Paranormal Activity, I think 2009.
Yeah. This was before kind of the jadedness of the internet, you know, before people were like diving deep into every single facet of films. And so I just went in. It was playing in Austin, I think, at the Alamo Draft House.
Oh, nice.
And there was just no information about it whatsoever. So going in blind and watching this movie that looked like home video.
Yeah.
I remember it just being the most terrifying experience. I just, and that's like such a lightning in the bottle kind of a situation.
Absolutely.
Because it's like, now how do you recreate that where we literally know every single thing about a movie being made?
Yeah.
Now, I don't know if you could keep a movie like that. I think about that all the time. Like, I love found footage films, but how do you scare a person like that? Because we were just so trusting, I guess, you know?
I mean, that movie was, it was so brilliant in its minimalist approach and the way that it would hold a shot. Because the thing is, like, every director would tell you, you can't hold a static shot where nothing's happening for more than a few seconds. That's just death on screen. But the way that the movie, and I say this positively, manipulated us as audience members to look for things, and that they could hold a static shot because they knew that our eyes were going around every frame or every piece of that frame trying to see, like, is that shadow moving? Is that, you know? And then, like, because of the way that it would direct our attention to the upper right-hand corner of the screen, so that when the, you know, the blanket's ripped off, all of a sudden we're, you know, our eyes dart to the other side. We're like, ah, what's going on? It's so smart the way
it was. I mean, like, that kind of filmmaking, I think you nailed it. Like, holding that shot only builds more tension.
Exactly.
Because you're just watching, being like, what's happening? What's going to happen? What's going to happen? And you're scanning every single corner to try to figure out, what am I supposed to be looking at? And then by the time that you do discover, I love stuff like that where it's like, oh, you were looking over here, but did you see the shadow moving over here? You didn't notice the shadow moving over there? And then you're even more freaked out. Oh my God. I love stuff like that so, so, so much. So you started, you were doing playwriting.
Yes.
And so the jump from playwriting to screenwriting, how was that for you? Like, how was the transition? Did you have any sort of troubles with making that leap? And have you discovered anything about screenwriting that's different from playwriting?
Oh God, yeah. I mean, they're worlds apart, which is funny because, you know, one would think that it's a pretty similar skill set, but it's really not. Like, playwriting is a very interesting beast. And I would say probably less structured than screenwriting because, you know, if all that you're given instruction-wise as a playwright is like, here's a blank stage, fill it and create the world however you want to, whatever that means for you. So you can really go in a lot of different ways. And also theater audiences will show up for things like, if you want to write an entire play in verse, but it takes place, you know, in the modern day, theater audiences will see that. Film audiences, maybe not so much. I mean, some might, you know, with experimental film and stuff. But for the most part, when you're writing for the screen, you're aiming to, you know, cast as wide a net as possible. But yeah, it's a different skill set. I will say, like, I've taken a lot of classes. I've done a lot of training. I've joined a lot of writers groups. You know, in fairness, I've been studying screenwriting since I was in high school. But I never really focused on it exclusively until I realized like kind of my time in New York had ended and it was time to come to LA. And when I first came to LA, this is such like an amateur mistake. So I first came to LA and I, due to the relative success of the stage reading of my pilot, I actually got a general meeting at a network. And I went in and I talked to the VP of development at this network and, you know, he was really nice. And we talked a little bit about the script and he said, okay, great. So that's, you know, this thing, what else do you have that we can talk about or look at? And I said, oh, I have to have other things. You know, like I didn't know that. Nobody told me. Yeah. And now having been here for a while now, it's like, oh no, you want a portfolio that is stacked. So if they want a feature, you have a feature script. If they want, you know, a pilot, an hour long, you have this hour long pilot. You really want to have as much material as you can and also have pitch material for it. I guess that's probably the biggest difference between writing for the stage and writing for the screen is that specifically when you're writing for series is that, not only do you have the script, which quite frankly, you're lucky if anyone in LA actually read it anyway, but you also have to have a lookbook where you describe what the series will be like. You have to have a 5-season plan. You have to have all these kind of you know, background material that's really the bulk of any of any meeting that you're going to get. Scripts are almost kind of a second thought for a lot of people, which, except for writers, in which case, like, we're obsessed with writing scripts, and that's, you know, our prime objective. But yeah,
probably the biggest difference. Nobody really like says that explicitly though, you know, I mean, like such a, I'm really interested in filmmaking myself and writing. Mm-hmm. And nobody really ever says that, that you have to have all this sort of supplemental material to go along with it.
Right.
And you have to have all these diverse pieces to also, cause so much of the conversation is like, your one perfect script. I'm working on this script that's just going to be like the best new American, you know, Oscar winning script. And then when people look at you and they say, okay, well, what else do you have? And you're just like, just this, just been working on this for 7 years.
So. Exactly. Yeah. If it takes you 7 years to write a script, probably you need to work on your, you know, on your process, because you want to be able to, you know, like one of the things that, like I'm primarily interested in writing for television. So mostly what I write is pilots, hour long pilots. And a lot of those are in like the horror fantasy genre. Mm. And what people say is that you need to have two original pilots, and one spec script, which is a sample script of an existing television show to show that you can match style, per year. Mm-hmm. So minimum, you have to write those three scripts per year. Mm-hmm. And each year you have to have a new one, because once a year passes, your spec script is not usable anymore. Mm-hmm. Like if I have a spec script from season one of Sabrina, I can't use that because they're on season three now. Also, side note, I fucking love that show.
I was just watching it last night.
Me too. It's so good.
Oh my God. What episode am I on? I'm Nick just got out of hell. Which I'm grateful for. The show is also, speaking of mad horny, the show is mad horny.
It is the horniest show that I've seen. Like
I struggle with it.
I mean, I thought Buffy in its later seasons was horny, but then like, damn. And it's also like, I love Nick as representative of bisexuality that is like completely accepted in the world of Sabrina. And that doesn't disqualify him as a love interest for her, even though we as an audience, and she too, the character, very much is aware that his sexual desires seem split pretty evenly between men and women. And it's just like that. And it's so interesting to me that that is not a bigger deal in the fandom, like not more people are talking about that bi representation.
Yeah. I was just thinking about that last night. I was thinking about, because there was a scene with Nick, where he was in a BDSM dungeon, which is just what you do when you're 17 years old, which is
when they get out of hell. Yeah. I just go to a BDSM dungeon.
Totally. Which I was like, y'all, like, this is not okay, but all right. And he had two partners, like a femme presenting and a mask presenting partner. And I was there being like, okay, a bisexual king. We stand.
Yes.
And I was like, so stuck by that. And then, there's a character named Theo who
I love Theo
who has a love interest.
Yep.
And you know, they don't make a deal out of the I think the love interest
Robin.
Right, because they're based on a character from Midsummer
Night's Dream. Yeah, yes. He's Robin Goodfellow or Puck. Yeah.
And I was like, okay, yes, eighth grade literature class coming back for me, thank you. and yeah, like that, having Theo being genderqueer, using they them pronouns, the character, the real actor, also being genderqueer as well, and how influential that is to see a genderqueer person have a love interest, you know, this person who is, I think, for most of the show, I was like, oh, this person's going to be relegated to being the sidekick character. Everybody else is going to have love.
Yep.
Roz is going to have love. Sabrina's going to have love. But then this character is going to be like the funky, weird one in the background.
The neutered one in the background, right?
Yes. Yeah. And then they were like, no, we're going to give Theo a love interest. Mm-hmm. And it's super cute. It's super adorable.
I also love that the love interest is a boy, because I think a lot of people will expect, if you see a trans boy or genderqueer, but mask presenting, transitioning, and sort of assuming that, you know, masculinity, that then his love interest will be a girl. But I love that they're showing that it's a lot more fluid than that. It's not, you know, they're taking those binaries out of it. So, you know.
I love it. I love it so much. And I was also thinking about, like, where is the queer fandom? Like, where,
you know. Especially with Ambrose, who's the hottest guy I've ever seen on screen.
No, and I was also thinking about Ambrose, because I was thinking, like, who's my bisexual king? Ambrose came in, and I was like, also a bisexual / pansexual king. We stand.
Yes, and he's a witch, so he has magic. I just love him so much, and his voice is just, I think, what gets me. Like, he's so beautiful to look at, and his body's amazing. But just there's something about that, like, husky British accent that he speaks in, where I'm just like, I get my clack fan out and like, oh, okay.
Tim, if you get on your next project, if you get a role for that character, please, or for that actor, please consider them, because
lips to God's ears to work with that guy.
Why isn't this man in everything? Because I'm obsessed. First of all, he has this sort of like regal Shakespearean quality to him, but his personality is so fun. He's so sexy. He's everything. And I was looking him up, and I was just like, he needs to be in a million more things.
I mean, I have a feeling like this is such a vehicle for him. I have a feeling like he's going to be fine. I think he's going to get a lot of offers after.
Oh my God. Yeah. The whole cast, I think, is really great. And I'm like high key obsessed with all of them. I also was looking up, I don't know if you've ever seen, this might be not a hot take, but a sidebar, the guy that plays Robin Goodfellow is like jacked. He's like uncomfortably thick.
Really?
Yes.
They put him in those big coats, so you can't really get.
I know. I looked up his Instagram, and I was like, "Really, really, baby, you got all this under this coat? Really, you're just gonna hide this?"
I'm sure that will be revealed at some point in the show, because they like to take everyone's clothes off.
Oh my God, the show is so. My issues with it, I do feel. Because right now in the show, there is an episode that's all about like how horny Harvey is.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, like I get it. They're teenagers and they're mad horny. And also none of the actors, I think, are under 18. I think they're all over 18.
Oh no, they're all like in their 20s. They're well in their
20s. And 30s. Yeah.
I love sexy Ambrose, but I would be very surprised if he were like anything under 28, 29, like probably in his 30s would be my guess. Yeah.
Which is great. You know, like,
I'm in my 30s. I'm for it.
Seriously. So I can safely objectify these people. But you know, it's a lot of horniness for a show about teenagers, to where I'm just kind of like, all right, it's like how I feel about watching Euphoria, where I'm just like, watching these teenagers. Fuck. This is like weird.
It is interesting. Yeah, that's true. That's something that like, it's funny, there was one time I saw this theatrical production about like, and it was all about like teenagers having, it wasn't Spring Awakening, but it was all about like teenagers having sex and stuff. But the teenagers on stage were played by actual teenagers, like 16 or 17. And literally like they stripped down to their underwear and kiss. And it was the most uncomfortable I've ever felt in a theater. Yeah. And literally sitting there, it finally clicked for me. I'm like, that's why they cast 20 somethings as teenagers in shows and movies, so that we as an audience, like, we suspend the disbelief that they're like, sure, they're teenagers, but there's a part of us that always knows like, this is totally fine, these actors are totally legal, this does not cross any weird boundaries or anything. But yeah.
It's different. It hits you differently because I remember watching Skins when I was a teenager. And that show is all about teenagers fucking. But I was also a teenager when I was watching that. So it hits you differently than when you're an adult and you're watching teenagers fucking and you're just kind of like, I feel like the mom from Mean Girls where I'm just like, you kids using condoms? You kids want snacks? You guys using protection? Like, I just feel so like weirdly protective of them, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And
which
I think is a normal, healthy thing for adults to feel.
I hope so. God, I hope so. That I'm just like in the background of this like witch orgy, just being like, you kids using lube? You kids using protection?
And there's tenuous consent. We're good? Okay. We're constantly checking in with each other? Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and so it's, I mean, I love the show. I love what it's doing. If I were 15 years old, this would be the show definitively would be my show.
Like, when I was 15, I was so starved for any kind of queer representation at all, like let alone having a gay character or a queer character be integral to the plot, but literally just them existing. Like, even if there was one character who said that they were gay and they were like in the background in one episode, it would still be my favorite show. Yeah. So it shows like how far we've really come, you know? Yeah. It's so funny because when I sat down to write Demon Hunter, that was something that I was like, I'm going to write like the action horror show that I've always wanted to see. And it's going to be queer as fuck. And all these characters are going to be queer and it's going to blow the lid off of stuff. But in the time that I, from when I started to write it to us making it, that's already happening. Like, it's really amazing. Like, even with like Sense8 and certainly Sabrina, but all sorts of shows are like really heavy in queer representation now, which is so cool. It's a very exciting time to be like a queer fan of genre.
So does that help your comps? Like, does it help you to be able to have these other things to compare it to when you're talking to people about it?
Absolutely. It's funny because in a way it helps and in a way it hinders, because in like it used to be that if you were going to make something like Demon Hunter in the landscape of really just a few years ago, it would catch everyone's attention because it was so different. But now it's like a little bit less groundbreaking because we're seeing all these other great shows on. But that's fine. I mean, that's what we call a high-end problem, because I like to see representation. But yeah, no, it certainly does help. Like, especially now, for a long time, I was telling people like, the only way to describe Demon Hunter was Buffy the Vampire Slayer meets Queer as Folk, which are dated references. Those are not exactly current shows. But I was like, that's the only really thing that I can think of. Whereas now I just say it's very much like Sabrina, just the characters are older, they're adults, they're all like in their, you know, 20s and 30s. And there's no pretty blonde white girl. it's like primarily people of color and queer people and all that kind of stuff. So it's like a straight blonde white girl is actually, I don't even think there's a single straight blonde white girl in the entire show at all.
I stand that. yeah. I mean, you know, I think that's really interesting because I still think that there's room for a show like that because of the fact that if you do get representation, it's still largely white. Yes. It's still largely like heterosexual, hetero leaning, you know? Yeah. And so I still feel like there's so much excitement about your show, which is why I reached out to you, because I was just like, I've got to connect with this person. I've got to know more about this show, because I would have wanted, more representation to see more people like myself. I mean, you understand this, like being a horror fan from a marginalized community is sometimes such a, a one-sided love affair.
Yes.
It's like, I love you, but do you love me the same way that I love you? And I'm going to love this genre regardless of how the genre is treating me. Mm-hmm. Your queer representation in horror movies is mostly stereotypes. It's mostly queer codedness. It's mostly like queer readings where you have to put on your queer glasses.
Yeah.
Like, can I see through the subtext and find the queerness in this movie?
Right.
Which kind of drives me now it drives me crazy. I think before I used to be all about that, where I was just like, Babadook, gay. Pennywise, gay. Like, everybody was gay. But now I'm just like, unless you're taking like a hot dick to the rear, you're not, it's not enough for me. I need text. I don't need subtext.
Well, you know, funny you should mention that, because literally in the very first episode of Demon Hunter, without spoiling too much, there is, I think we're 4 minutes in when there's a hot dick to the rear scene, pretty explicit.
Thank you.
And you know, it's funny that you speak about being a fan and being part of marginalized community and having it be a one-way love affair. And I totally understand that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that that I was really set on when I started to write this, because, you know, my lived experience is as a gay man. So it's like, I knew that I was going to bring a lot of that into it, but I also really wanted to make sure that we had total gender parity, so that there was, you know, at the end when we have 60 demon hunters at the end of the season, it's 3 men, it's 3 women, and the 3 women are Natalia, who plays a bisexual, or who is a bisexual witch, played by our friend Yaz, and then a lesbian private eye stoner, and then an immortal genie. And so you have these 3 women, and they're all women of color, and they're all queer. One is bisexual, one is lesbian, one is pansexual. And we were filming the scene where the 3 of them were talking to each other, and I was there with my DP, who's also a gay man, and we were talking to the AC, who's an assistant camera person, and she's a gay woman, and we're just looking at this, and she just turns to me, she's like, I've never seen anything like this in any kind of like genre film, where it's just like 3 queer women of color that are in a love triangle, there's tension, it has nothing to do with the men around them, it's like their story and stuff. So I love that, you know, because it's 6 episodes, it gives us breathing room, as opposed to like a movie where you have to like keep your main character in the main through line, and just like, that's really all you get to do, with a little bit of subplot. But when you have, you know, when your structure is episodic, it can feel a little bit more of an anthology. So you can have a little bit of this storyline, have a little bit of that storyline. But yeah, so that's like something that I was really thinking about a lot when we were creating this, is like, a lot of us never get to see ourselves on screen, even now. So it's so important to get to see that. And it's also fun. Just queer stories are more fun.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that it's like, one, it's a representation of real life. It feels more authentic, mm-hmm. you know? And then it's also this idea of having so many more stories to tell. Mm-hmm. So you have so much more of a richer material to kind of pull from than if you were just kind of doing the same plot lines over and over again. I mean, you know, as a queer Black female horror movie fan, it has been a real struggle to sort of find stuff that I feel, one, is comfortable, mm-hmm. you know, that makes me feel comfortable when I'm watching it. And it's been happening, I want to say, I sort of use like Get Out as the marker a lot of the time. Yeah. Like there's like pre-Get Out and there's post-Get Out, because I feel like once Get Out happened, the conversation around horror movies changed, where it was like, it wasn't enough to just have a movie that had scares, that had blood, that had gore.
Yep.
The movie had to say something at the same time. It had to be substantive in some sort of way.
Yes.
And it wasn't enough to just sort of be like, okay, if this movie has chainsaws and virgins dying in the woods and stuff like that. Now, do you feel like the conversation around horror movies, that people are taking them a little bit more seriously?
I do. I think the best thing that happened to horror in the past few years is that that double punch of Jordan Peele, and then I always forget his name. Is it Ari Aster who did Midsommar and Hereditary?
Ari Aster, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, and the fact that they both came on the scene in pretty much around the same time, mm-hmm. both working in horror but doing very different things, I think it was just all of a sudden, you know, horror was revived as this prestige genre that it hasn't felt like in a long time. But also, it's like, it's so amazing to me, because, I mean, like, Jordan Peele's work is so incredible, not just on Get Out and Us, but also on The Twilight Zone. Mm-hmm. And like, I just can't believe that it's Jordan Peele, because I watched Key and Peele so much because it was so funny and he's so hilarious. And like, I always just remember thinking like, he's the slightly funnier but less handsome half of Key and Peele.
Okay, now I know your taste. Okay. But the thing is if you watch episodes of Key and Peele, there's a lot of horror episodes.
There are, and you know that was Jordan Peele's influence. And then totally. And he said something, and I'll never forget this because I thought it was he's so good at saying such smart things concisely, which is a skill that I'm working on and I'm not good at it. But he was talking about the relationship between horror and comedy. Mm. And what he said was everything about those two genres are so similar, except the effect that they have on the audience. But both of them are about having an inciting incident that you kind of feel you know is where it's going to go, having that rising tension, and then having a release of tension. Mm-hmm. And that release of tension in comedy comes in the form of like a big belly laugh, and the release in tension in horror comes from a scream, like a guttural scream where you're really scared. But it's all about manipulating, in a good way, the audiences on that journey. And I just remember, I was like, that's why there's such a great relationship between horror and comedy, because they're the same thing. Or they're not the same thing, but they're opposite sides of the same coin, I guess.
Totally. And like, it's the same sort of like build and tension, right? Because it's the longer and the thinner that you hold out that tension, the more you stretch it, the better the payoff, you know? Right. And it's that sort of subversion. I love, you know, it's like the rule of three. So you have the rule of three in comedy where you can do a joke three times and that's kind of it. But it's also the same, you have the rule of three in horror as well, where you can do this fake scare, right? Mm-hmm. It's the sound in the dark. Oh, it's actually the cat. Okay. Then it's the sound at the window. Oh, it's actually a tree branch. And then there's the sound in the house. It's actually the killer. And there's also the rule of three in horror as well. And I feel like Jordan was able to bridge that gap so well.
Literally.
Man, I think of the one skit that he did that's my absolute favorite, which is the, oh my God, the Make-A-Wish one. But the kid is like a demon. Okay. I'm gonna put it in the show notes because it's my favorite one. But it's the one where the kid is Satan. He's literally Satan. And like they're like, what would you like for your final wish? And he's like, I would want your flesh. I want to eat your flesh. I want your skin. And they're like, whoa, no, we can't give you that. And it's just it's the perfect combination of horror and comedy.
Yes. It's
this subversion of both of those things happening at the same time. Literally, I have studied this episode like on an academic level. Because I also teach classes as well. And that's one of the things that I've taught about is like how he lines that up so perfectly.
It's so good.
And I would say like it's like Ari Aster, Robert Edgers, who did The Lighthouse and The Witch.
Yep.
Jennifer Kent, who did The Babadook and The Nightingale.
Which I still haven't seen The Nightingale, by the way. That's on my list. I haven't seen it yet.
It's a movie.
Okay.
It's a movie. Okay. It's another one where people like, you know how people have conversation, is it horror or is it not horror, you know?
Yeah. Like Parasite, people are talking about that a lot.
Yeah, Parasite to me, Parasite is not a horror movie unless you consider like rich people terrifying, which
I do find them terrifying.
Fair.
I mean, I it's funny because I remember like when they had the little flashback to when the kids saw the maid's husband like coming out in the middle of the night. That scared me. That shot was
the shit out of me. Oh my god!
This I think this is a horror movie, and it certainly plays with like horror tropes.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I'm kind of at this point now where I'm like, I feel like sometimes when those lines are so blurred, I'm kind of like, however you want to see it is valid to me.
Yeah.
If you feel this is a horror movie, absolutely a horror movie. I'm not going to be a gatekeeper on what it is, but yeah. Ooh. And also, like, you know, we're recording this the day after the Oscars and it just won. So
I didn't watch the Oscars this year because I was like, my heart can't take it. I can't do it. Yeah. Like I can't watch Ford v Ferrari win an Oscar right now. I can't do it.
What, you did not think that was the pinnacle of filmmaking?
No, I really didn't. And I couldn't, like, I was, because I, you know, I'm such a huge fan of, like, The Farewell. There were so many other movies.
Yeah.
High key. I'm not, you know, ashamed to say that. There were so many other movies. And so I was like, give me the results tomorrow. I can wait. And I woke up, and the first thing I saw on Twitter was congratulations to the cast of Parasite for winning. And I thought, first when I saw it, I thought, oh, yeah, of course they won Best Foreign Film. No.
No.
They won Best Picture and Best Foreign Film.
Mm-hmm.
Wild. Couldn't believe it.
It is wild.
I mean, it deserved to win. But that scene where the housekeeper's husband comes up slowly.
Oh, so scary.
From this, and the way his eyes are lit to where it's just, you can just see the white of his eyes completely.
It was so scary.
You don't know exactly what you're looking at, right? Like,
right.
It's happening and you're just sort of like, what is that? And you totally understand now why this little boy has so much trauma.
Yes.
Because it was so effectively terrifying, just that one part. And I did scream, like, when that happened. I literally... Yeah. Like, crawled up over my seat. That was the scariest. And I watch horror movies for fun. And that was the most terrifying scene. Oh my God. Oh my God. So good. I just lost my train of thought because all I can think about is how good that movie is. Oh, so The Nightingale is a rape revenge horror movie.
Right.
Which I've never really been a big fan of ever.
Yeah.
You know? For obvious reasons, but the way in which Jennifer Kent handles the material, in which she handles survival as a rape victim, is so deft. And also the relationship between the main character and the Aboriginal character is also really good. But my God, is it a movie? It's 90 minutes of just pure unadulterated sexism, and it's that in itself, I think, makes it a horror movie, because it's just like, have you ever wondered what it's like to be a woman? Well, now you get it. In 90 minutes, just everything horrible about being a woman in one film, and it's a lot, but it is very good. But I never want to see it again. Once was enough.
Good. Yeah.
I think that horror has really had this new kind of conversation where people are taking it more seriously, more, you know, I hate using the E word, I hate using elevated, because horror movies have always had that, you know, just because of the fact that some people are discovering it now doesn't mean that horror hasn't had it before, but I think that there's more of this conversation of like, but what does it bring, you know?
Yeah.
And with your production bringing something new to this conversation, there's still so much room. I can say this as somebody who goes to a lot of film festivals. Seeing your, you know, seeing your work would have been a breath of fresh air. What do you intend to do with it afterwards? Do you intend to do the festival circuit or just release it online?
So what we're going to do now is, now that we're starting to edit the episodes together, we are going to submit them to festivals. We're hoping to do the festival circuit. And then after that, we're searching for distribution. So we'll see where that takes us.
Nice. Yeah. And there's so much online now. There's like so many different platforms now.
So many different streaming services. Yeah.
Yeah. Like new ones every single year. So, and I wanted to ask also for your production company, this is kind of like the first piece that you're making that will kind of get your name out there and expand your profile.
That's correct.
Is there, what is the long-term plan with the production company? What do you hope to do in the future?
Well, our goal is to just keep creating shows that are genre-based, mostly horror-based, and that champion the stories of queer people, LGBTQ, obviously, people of color, and women, and just, you know, do the, you know, make the content that we all really want to see, and just populate it with the kind of people that we want to see as the leads, and not have to explain it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so awesome.
Thank you.
Tim, I can't believe this, but we're like almost out of time.
Oh, okay. This was fun. This was so fun.
Thank you. This was a really great conversation. I feel like we could talk about this a lot more, or we could just talk about who do we stand in Sabrina? We could just talk more about Sabrina season 3. Well, Tim, can you give the listeners more information about where to find you and what's going on with your production company right now?
Yeah, absolutely. The best way to follow us is just on all the social medias. So if you go to Demon Hunter Show, that's DemonHunter Show on Twitter and Facebook, and Demon Hunter Series on Instagram. And that will give you all of the cool updates and let you know what we're doing.
Awesome. Yeah. And I'll put that in the show notes so that everybody can check that out afterwards. Thank you so much, Tim. I'm so glad that this worked out. This was such a good conversation. Yeah. I wish you so much good luck with your production. I cannot wait to see it. And yay. I'd love to have you come back after, you know, you put some episodes up so we can talk about the show and we can talk about where you're at afterwards. I think after I get to see everything, I think it would be really interesting to follow up with you.
Yeah, anytime. I'd love to.
Great. Awesome. Well, thank you to the listeners for coming back again. I know that you can't get enough of me. I know that if you could, you would eat me piece by piece. I know that I'm delicious and delectable, but I have to say goodbye. Until next time, dear listener, follow me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and I will see you again. Bye. Thank you so much for listening to tonight's episode, and thank you again to my guest, Tim. Please check out all of his projects that he's working on. Check in with him, tell him how great he is, ask him again about Sabrina season 3. It's such a good time talking to him. As I was listening to this again, I was just laughing all over again. It was such a great conversation. What a great person. Oh my goodness. Everybody stay safe out there. Wash your hands. Stay 6 feet apart from each other. Do not celebrate birthdays. Do not go outside to celebrate grandpa's retirement or any of that nonsense. I swear, if I see any of you outside having parties, celebrations, quinceañeras, I will roll through and destroy the place. So the sooner you guys get inside and stay inside, the sooner I can leave outside. So think of me. Think of my sacrifice throughout all of this. All right, everybody, stay safe, wash your hands, stay inside, stay 6 feet apart from each other, and take care of yourselves. Bye! See you again in another 2 weeks when I'll be back. That's a threat. Also, watch my live show. Do it. Do it. Please? Do it. Bye!